This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations. Donald Trump's presidency, even before it officially began, drew immediate comparisons to Richard Nixon. President Nixon was considered by most historians to have the darkest presidential legacy, having had a meteoric rise in his political career only to become the first president to resign in disgrace after the Watergate scandal broke. Nixon's paranoia, race-baiting, fear-mongering, divisiveness, and secrecy were his undoing. Today, the definitive biography of Richard Nixon by my guest, John A. Farrell, couldn't have come at a more relevant time. The New York Times called the 700-page tour de force a, quote, portrait of a thin-skinned, media-hating president. John A. Farrell is the author of Clarence Darrow, Attorney for the Damned, which won the LA Times Book Prize for Biography, and Tip O'Neill and the Democratic Century. He's a longtime journalist who's worked at the Denver Post and at the Boston Globe, where he served as White House correspondent. He now joins me to discuss his brand new book, Richard Nixon, The Life. Welcome to the program, John.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So obviously, a lot of the press attention that your book is getting is hooking it to the current president that we have. And you obviously wouldn't have known when you started working on this book that we would be in this very interesting moment. But of course, for you, I think it's really great to see these comparisons. However, of course, Richard Nixon was very different from Trump, with some exceptions where there were some similarities. I'd like to focus on the Trump similarities later in our conversation. Let's talk first about how fast Richard Nixon went from being nothing in the political world to being president. He did go the more traditional route by first becoming congressman, House of Representative, then senator, and then president. What drew him to politics as a young man?
His parents believed in education, even though that we came from a very poor California farm family. And from the beginning, he was always borrowing other families' National Geographics and biographies of famous men, reading the paper every night. So I think he was just naturally inclined a political way, which is kind of surprising because there's nobody else in his family who was in politics. He didn't have any friends who were in politics. And he really went, as you said, went from a complete nobody to vice president of the United States in 6 years.
And he was basically brought in as a sort of maverick candidate to beat a well-established, well-liked Democrat in Southern California for a Southern California audience where we are based. Nixon was from Whittier. And so he was basically drafted to beat this Democrat almost as a long shot, but he won, right?
He did. They called him the Dragon Slayer. Nobody gave him a chance. He had a very strong wind behind him because this was right after World War II. It was 1946. And people were ready for a change after all those years of regimentation and hard work during the Great Depression and then winning the war. And so when the Republicans came along in 1946, they had a compelling argument that it was time for a change. And in fact, they won both houses of Congress for the first time since the beginning of the New Deal. But Nixon also had a slashing form of campaigning. He was on the attack, and he painted his opponent as a communist sympathizer, which was kind of amazing since the opponent's great claim to fame up to that time was in sponsoring a bill against communists in the United States. So Nixon was a very skillful race baiter from the very beginning. And in my research in the Nixon Library, I also found an interesting set of a to-do list, a big to-do list on a yellow legal pad. And his opponents was named by a guy by the name of Jerry Voorhees. And at the bottom of this list was Nixon had written to himself, "Put spies in Voorhees campaign." Huh. So he also had a nose for intrigue from the very beginning.
So can you describe what sort of personality he had? Obviously, you did this biography. Your biography is based on research. and based on the testimonies of people who knew him, I mean, we think of him as this brooding man who was filled with paranoia. But of course, each person is much more three-dimensional in real life. So who was Nixon the person?
I was actually surprised at how much sympathy I gained for him as I did the research into the book. He came from a very Dickensian family. He had two brothers die in their youth. His father was a brutish man. His mother would retreat into her closet to pray. And as Nixon famously said, never in my life did my mother ever tell me that she loved me. So he really had to drag himself up. As somebody said, one of his close friends said, Richard Nixon went up the walls of life with his claws. And so he had this sort of basic feeling of grievance, even as a young man. Then he gets into politics and he discovers that he can identify this and tap it in others. And that begins this great polarization that we have to this day. So in some ways, there's this great continuum between Nixon being treated poorly at home, finding out that he can reach out to his audiences, tap their grievances on race, on class, and get them to vote for him. And it's a style of politicians that politicians carry on even now.
Right, and even
most notably. Utterly Donald Trump.
Yes. Now, unlike Trump, Nixon, as you said, was not born into money. Yet from reading your book, I get the sense that he felt that he was destined for greatness. His wife, Pat, believed that about him as well. How much of that sort of played into this meteoric rise that we saw, even though he was just not the kind of charismatic political figure one feels, is justified in having those illusions about oneself?
Yeah, one of the things about Nixon was that he had this fetish for self-control and this amazing drive, and nobody would ever outwork him. So when he was challenged, he was very insecure. And that's where you get this sort of paranoia and the press is the enemy and this lashing out at his foes. That finally leads him to a catastrophic end. And that was his great tragic flaw.
So let's talk about how he built up his political career towards vice president and then president, of course. You mentioned that he tried the sort of anti-communist attack in his first campaign for the House of Representatives. He went back to that again and again, didn't he? Tell us about the story of Alger Hiss, for example.
Well, he gets to Congress, and by choice, he goes on the House Un-American Activities Committee, which was the major red hunting committee of its day, and played a role in identifying and bringing to justice a communist spy named Alger Hiss, who had worked at the top levels of the State Department. It was a very controversial fight. He took an awful lot of heat from the left, but he persevered and followed it through, and Hiss was finally convicted of perjury. So he uses that as a springboard then in 1950 to run for the U.S. Senate against another liberal Democrat, Helen Gahagan Douglas. And this, of course, is the year that the Korean War breaks out, and the voters are very, very receptive to an anti-communist argument. It's also the year that Joe McCarthy emerges almost as Nixon is almost acts as a mentor to McCarthy. McCarthy's first speech, the famous one where he waves the piece of paper and says, "I have here a list of the communists in the State Department." He had lifted whole segments of that speech from one of Nixon's addresses. So Nixon, in many ways, was sort of a John the Baptist for the McCarthyism era. And it brought him some serious knocks when he was chosen as vice president for Eisenhower, because Eisenhower was not somebody who would cotton with McCarthy. But Nixon really wanted the anti-communist theme to be strong in the Republican Party. And so they had a clash in the first 2 years of the Eisenhower administration, and Nixon came off the worse for it.
Now, when Nixon basically became the running mate for Dwight Eisenhower, did he have an eye towards the presidency, something that did eventually come several years later?
Not really. In fact, there was a point in his first 2 years in office where he was having such difficulty coping. Remember, he'd only been in politics for 6 years. Now, all of a sudden, the eyes of the nation are on him. He's on the cover of Time magazine. He's taking all this abuse from the Washington Post, from Herb Block, the cartoonist. And he's having a miserable time because for vice presidents is a miserable job, but particularly when you're this young second lieutenant comes home from the war and you're working for the liberator of Europe, you're really feeling insignificant. And in fact, he was contemplating dropping out of politics when Eisenhower had a heart attack. And that thrust Nixon into the national stage in a big way. He handled that very capably, very skillfully, very tactfully. And all of a sudden, he was being spoken of as presidential material. That was the sort of the big break. Eisenhower never had that real confidence in Nixon at that point, though, and tried to replace him on the ticket for the 1956 campaign, which again sent Nixon into one of those downward spirals of bitterness. But he managed. He was nothing if not resilient, and he managed to climb out of that and get the nomination in 1960, and ran against John F. Kennedy.
And lost to John F. Kennedy, of course. One might
I
imagine that
was.
you wouldn't find two more different, at that time, nominees of two major parties than Nixon and Kennedy.
And yet they were good friends. They liked each other. Pat and Dick Nixon were invited to Jack and Jackie's wedding. And it wasn't until the end of the 1960 campaign when Nixon thought that the Kennedys, with all their good looks and all their breeding and money, had still stooped low enough to steal the election from him, that he really gets this real bitterness about the Kennedy family.
So let's talk
It was.
about Nixon, the president, which of course is the most interesting part of the story. So he wins the presidency in 1968, right? Of course, these are very tumultuous times in the United States. He begins his political career at a time of transition, and then he transitions to the presidency at another very tumultuous time of national transition. This is at a time when the civil rights movement is in full force. Of course, the anti-war movement is beginning. But interestingly enough, Nixon campaigns on what, by today's standards, is actually a progressive campaign, but he employs the Southern strategy doing it, right?
Yeah, well, he had the advantage that he had. The Democrats were in disarray. If you remember the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy and the riots in Chicago, they were very, as you said, tumultuous times. And the Democrats were in disarray on to the left. And to his right, he had George Wallace running as the real racist candidate. So Nixon had the advantage in that race of coaching his arguments in a moderate tone of voice, and winning by just a whisker over Hubert Humphrey with some real skullduggery right in October 1968, right before the election.
So he is the person who is also, we know, credited with ending the Vietnam War. But that happened after he first began the, or rather, I should say, expanded the war in Indochina, much to the anger of the anti-war movement. What were Nixon's views on war? And this, of course, is a question that becomes very relevant today, when we try to compare Nixon and Trump. What were his views on war? And does he really deserve the credit for ending the war, or does that credit really go to the anti-war movement?
Well, those are several questions. He was a young lieutenant in World War II. He had seen the use of atomic weapons. He had seen the use of strategic bombing by all forces, the Great Slaughter, 60 million dead in World War II. And so people of his generation still believe very much in the what Eisenhower called the domino theory, which is that you have to stop an aggressor at the beginning, or it leads to great catastrophes, and that they were accepting of the loss of human life in a great cause in ways that perhaps we aren't now. They had given a lot of blood to defeat Hitler and Mussolini and the Japanese. And Nixon carried that forward throughout the Cold War and into Vietnam. His view on Vietnam was that this was a holding action, that it was all about great global politics, not to free the Vietnamese people from communism as much as it was to preserve American prestige. And if that was the case, I argue in the book that he could have gotten out right away in 1968, blamed it all on his Democratic predecessors, and saved a lot of the bloodshed that happened. But instead, he continued the war until 1975. It lasted even past his term in office. And it ended in a rout anyway, and the communist victory anyway, and then the great tragedies of the Cambodia and the Vietnamese boat people. So it was a very messy ending with millions of Asians and another 20,000 Americans who died. The anti-war movement moved from the streets into Congress while Nixon was in office, and it was the congressional anti-war movement that really applied the most pressure on him because they were threatening to cut off the war-making funds. And so that's what pushed him to get a deal, and finally there were political considerations he wanted. He had campaigned in 68 as a peace candidate, and by 72 he wanted to have some sort of resolution of the war.
Now, wasn't he caught colluding with the South Vietnamese president that many are comparing to the allegations of the Trump folks colluding with the Russian government?
Yes, this was one of the things I discovered at the Nixon Presidential Library was a set of notes from Nixon talking to his chief of staff, Bob Haldeman, giving him orders during the 68 campaign. And it had always been rumored or alleged that Nixon had interceded with the South Vietnamese and told them, hold on, you'll get a better deal if I get elected. Don't sign on to Lyndon Johnson's fall 1968 peace initiative. But there had never been proof. We'd never been able to put the words actually in Nixon's mouth. And here at the library in Yorba Linda, California, I found this set of notes where he's barking orders to Haldeman, and he is saying, "Send Anna Chenault, who was a Nixon campaign official, to the South Vietnamese. Tell them to hold on. We're going to monkey wrench these peace talks." And he did. And wow. The South Vietnamese dragged their feet. You can hear him denying it in a phone call to an angry Lyndon Johnson at the time on the White House tapes. You can watch him deny it again in the famous David Frost interviews. So this was finally proof, evidence for history, that little piece of the jigsaw puzzle that puts wow. the words right into Nixon's mouth.
Well, that's amazing. Your book is hefty with a ton of research in it. Of course, we now know that members of the eventual Trump administration essentially were telling the Russians not to worry about U.S. sanctions on Russia until Trump was president. All right, let's talk about the relationship between Richard Nixon and the press. Now, we know that presidents tend to have a combative relationship with the press, which is how it should be. But today, under Donald Trump, the media has been declared the enemy of the White House. But that word enemy was something that Nixon first used when referring to the press, right?
Over and over again, he would say, the press is the enemy, the press is the enemy. Write that on a blackboard 100 times. The press is the enemy. The establishment is the enemy. The professors are the enemy. I hear a lot of enemies. But he never actually went so far as to say in public that the press was the enemy of the American people, which is what Trump said, which is which is the kind of talk that dictators use. Nixon had some basic respect for the American political system and the Constitution, having served as Eisenhower's vice president, that he would never have gone, I don't think, that far. And in fact, when all the odds were against him, he finally did resign rather than put the country through the turmoil of a trial in the Senate, or rather than to hold on to power extra legally.
So we have a president today who can't help but express himself loudly to the public. Of course, it helps that we have social media, and he tweets faster than he can think sometimes. Richard Nixon made use of the technology at the time, didn't he? He used the phone.
Yeah.
How did he use the phone and why?
He used the telephone, and also he taped his Oval Office, he taped his hideaway office, he taped many of his telephones. And the conversations that you hear on the Nixon White House tapes are very much like those tweets that the current president sends out. It's sort of a glimpse into the presidential id that you ordinarily wouldn't get with other presidents, where all the language that is filtered and goes out to the public is very stilted and formal. So there is that, definitely is that comparison. You also have the fact, as you pointed out, that in both cases, you're talking about break-ins at the Democratic National Committee. There's a great photo in the New York Times a few weeks ago of one of the actual file cabinets that was broken into in the Democratic headquarters during Watergate, and one of the servers that was broken into by the Russian hackers in this latest episode, sitting next to each other in the basement of the Democratic Party headquarters. So many, many similarities. Have no idea at this point where we're going to end up in this investigation, but this is day 75 of the Trump era. It took us 6 years of Nixon before we finally peaked with Watergate. But we've had all these things: protests in the streets, allegations of eavesdropping, the press is the enemy. It's very much like Nixon on speed dial.
Yeah,
could have it all in 75 days now. Yeah.
So Watergate, of course, is the word that people most associate with Nixon. But in the end, was it simply Watergate that was Nixon's undoing, or was it so much else, much of it part of Nixon's own doing?
Oh, I think that Nixon ordered the cover-up almost immediately. He supervised it for 18 months. There's no doubt that that was the immediate and prime reason that he had to leave office. He was obstructing justice, not obeying his constitutional oath. And the tapes, there's no doubt about the evidence now. But as soon as he left office, the American people had a taste for finding else what else had gone on. And there was a series of commissions and committee hearings, most notably the Church Committee on Capitol Hill, which revealed that throughout the entire post-war era, American presidents had been eavesdropping and opening mail and infiltrating peace groups and tailing people, that we'd had assassination plots against foreign leaders, that the Kennedys had bugged Martin Luther King, that LBJ had bugged the Mississippi Freedom Party. So the whole American faith in government was shattered in that 2 or 3 year period. Nixon's advocates say, well, there was a double standard, and in many ways there was, because this was a government that was really rich in sin. You had the first National Security Agency surveillance programs at that time, very reminiscent of sort of the fears that we have now about surveillance, about Big Brother.
Right. So there was the surveillance aspect as well that we didn't get to talk about very much, the race baiting aspect, the sort of racial polarization that Nixon took advantage of, that today Trump is taking advantage of and using to his benefit, sadly. Finally, we could talk for many more hours about your book, but let's end with the question of, having spent, I'm assuming, a long time researching and writing this book and knowing the life of Nixon intimately and seeing this real life saga play out in the White House today, are comparisons between the two presidents overblown? And what can we learn from Nixon's life about how the Trump presidency might play out?
Well, they both have a grandiosity about them, but they came from very different backgrounds. Nixon came from a very impoverished background. Trump from a family that perhaps was as cold to him, but never had to worry about material questions. Their governing their campaigning is very similar in that they reach out for, as you said, racial or class grievances and resentments, try to tap people's anger at Washington. Their governing, it's a little too early to tell right now how they're going to govern, but certainly there are elements that sound the same. But as you pointed out, Nixon had a Democratic Congress, and as he pursued his great geopolitical ambitions, they put a lot of progressive legislation on his desk that he worked with them and signed, including a national health care plan that did not get adopted, but was very, very similar to the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare.
I understand, so, even a sort of universal basic income type thing that that Nixon...
That was proposed. He signed legislation creating the EPA.
Which now Trump is trying to destroy.
Which, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you know, as they're governing right now, we don't know whether Trump will make a turn to the center. He seems to be, at this moment, uncertain as to whether or not he wants to stay with these far-right, alt-right figures that have been giving him disastrous advice so far. It will be interesting. One thing about Richard Nixon is that Richard Nixon knew where he was going and set a very firm structure within his administration to get there and the things that mattered to him. The idea that he would be spending golf, spending every weekend playing golf is just in no way like Richard Nixon at all.
Nixon was actually a hard worker, right?
Oh,
unlike Trump.
Incredible. Yeah. I mean, he had his lazy moments, but certainly he was, he had goals and he worked endlessly to achieve them. Very clear, defined goals, and he had the staff to do so.
Well, John, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I understand that you have a number of speaking events coming up. Give out a website where people can find out more about those.
Sure, jafarrell.com, jafarrell.com. Yep.
We'll post a link to that website, jafarrell, two R's, two L's, .com, on our website later today. John, good luck with the book, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Sonali.
My guest is John A. Farrell, a longtime journalist who's worked at the Denver Post and at the Boston Globe, where he served as White House correspondent. And his book about Clarence Darrow won the best LA Times Book Award for Best Biography. He's been speaking with me about his newest book, Richard Nixon, The Life. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.